politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Adam!
Hello, darling!
Oh, I love you too. Hello.
Oh, bitchy, 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 bitchy.
Travis?
I'm feeling very Gentile here.
Okay, so Apple, Google, and Microsoft, they all announced plans to end the password as we now know it.
That's dumb.
Really?
I don't like it. I like having passwords, and I don't want to talk about that anyway.
But that means I can't use, 123456 as my password anymore?
I still don't want to talk
Travis
about it.
Or Travis 9876.
Why don't you ask me what I do want to talk about?
Okay. Travis?
Yes.
What do you think Bo wants to talk about today?
I think he wants to talk about how his password was still.
No. You don't. Sorry. Guys, I want to talk about things. No, I've been spending the last 3 days, and you know this. I can't believe neither of you are like, duh, we want to talk about your scammer.
Let's start with, I hear rumors that you have been jousting with a scammer.
You don't get a do-over. All right, fine. You get
do-over. No, it's not a do-over.
I think it just qualified as a snark.
Snark? Listen.
Yeah, not a do-over.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, Adam.
Is that anything like Quark snark?
No, Quark is a German dairy product.
That's dark.
Well, or a nanoparticle. But
we're doing this on a lark.
Guys, I almost knocked it out of the park. I almost knocked it out of the park. And ask me how? How, okay. Bro?
Well, because you're like a shark?
Bro?
It was a shark. All right, no more rhyming. I'm serious. All right, okay. So.
I think, Bo, we're barking up the wrong tree.
Oh, my God. I'm not going to tell you my story anymore.
Oh, come on. You met a guy in the park.
No, I met him on Instagram, and he offered me 5,000.
And there's a spark.
I hate you guys. I actually hate you guys. I've known you too long, and you're taking advantage of my niceness. All right.
That was a reach.
That was terrible. But it was all terrible, and I still don't like you. But so here's
okay,
the deal.
So back to passwords.
No. Instagram. On Instagram.
Scammer. A man is trying to scam you.
A person.
A human.
A human by the last name of Davis, according to his whatchamacallit, Thomas Davis. Hi, Thomas. Thomas Davis.
Thomas!
He won $390 million in a lottery.
$390 million.
Yeah. And so he got in touch with me.
Yes.
Because he wanted to spread his money around to people who needed it. This dude offered me $5,000. And I was super excited, and I wrote back to him. And I think I told you, Adam, I sent you what I wrote back to him. I don't remember what I wrote, though.
Back and forth. It's actually very inspiring from the standpoint of non-scammers.
I wrote, yes. Yeah, yes, exclamation point. And he said, well, do you have a Cash App, PayPal, Zelle, or Venmo to receive payment? Are you following my Instagram account? Because that was the deal. You had to follow his Instagram account. That was it. You got $5,000. So I said, I'm following. I have Venmo. Is there a tax issue? I worry about scams where money is sent and then canceled and in between overpayment is made and requested and then I'm out the money. I co-host a show about scams, so I'm super cautious. Hey, you want to be on the show?
Yeah, let's bring Tom on.
So I wrote back to him, amazing. And he said, you don't need to be scared, he says to me. I'm real and legitimate and you are with the right man. I'm going to need you to send me your Venmo username so I can send the money and also your valid email address. I said, okay, I just tried to get into my Venmo account and it seems to be locked because I didn't want to give him my real Venmo. I said, my best friend is a tech guy. That's Travis. And he's dropping his kids off at school right now. He said he'd help me when he's free. Shouldn't be long. I can't believe my rotten luck. And then I sent him a lot of emojis that expressed my rotten luck. Travis, What were you going to do at this point?
I was going to set up a burner phone number, a separate Venmo account, separate email address, just to make sure that we had a bit of a buffer between ourselves and this guy.
So Adam, he has like the Jeopardy waiting tune. Dun, 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 dun. So he's like sitting there waiting for me and I go, he says, okay, right? He's like, cool. Here's the kicker. He goes, so you'll have to pay $30 to my personal assistant account registration fee. So I wrote back and this is where it got funny. I go, are you kidding me? I got to wait for my friend. Wait, totally. Wait, he asked me to ask you. If you have $390 million, why do you need me to send $30? Said, sound a little fishy.
I'm dying to hear his response.
Well, I also said, would you be on our show about scammers? I promise not to turn you in, which we could do since we have worked with a retired Secret Service agent and a white hat hacker with close ties to the letter agencies. Eh, I just want to interview an authentic small-time swindler. Is it possible? We can disguise your voice and you can tell us funny stories about people who fall for this nonsense.
Was he offended when you referred to him as a small-time swindler?
No, it's so funny. I wrote back, I said, we'll give you $250. He writes back, lol, LOL.
Well, hey, that's more than 30.
Yeah, I said, so he said, I'm using this opportunity to support the community in this hard times. Now he starts to show that he's in a boiler room.
Did he send you his 501c3 papers?
Yes. No, he didn't. Yeah. So this hard times. So we have like, that's red flag numero uno, right? And then besides the whole thing. And he goes, I really want to help more people with my winnings. The $30 is for registration.
Ah.
You know, I wrote back $1,000. He wrote back, are you ready to pay for the registration fee and receive your money? 2 question marks. I wrote back, come on, we already know the scam. We'd like to interview you. It's more than you make with a bunch of $30 idiots. Come on. LOL, he writes back. Easy money, I write back. I'll tell you what, I'll put $1,000 in your Venmo account and then another $5,000 when you do a 1-hour tell-all interview. What do you have to lose? Ta-da! He has not responded to me.
Maybe we should send him like a group communication.
I mean, I'm going to tell him to listen to the podcast. Thomas Davis, Adam, invite him. Come on.
Thomas Davis, wherever you are, whoever you are, we need you to listen to this podcast. And by the way, as you're listening, if you could go to Apple and give us 5 stars, that would be great too.
What is wrong with you? Saw that happen.
Welcome to What the Hack, a show about hackers, scammers, and the people they go after. I'm Adam Levin, Cyber Rabbi.
I'm Bo, Cyber Baptizer of Strangers in a madcap way until I get my head cut off.
And I'm Travis, Cyber Fist of Khonshu.
And today we're talking with a former privacy officer at Microsoft and the current global head, get that, global head, of security at Avast. Please welcome Jeff Williams.
This spring, get out there, enjoy the weather, and recapture the magic of riding a bike with electric e-bike.
With an amazing variety of models built for riders of all abilities, it's never been easier to fall in love with riding again. Plus, every electric e-bike ships free and only requires quick, toolless assembly.
This is my first ever e-bike, and the experience has just been great. I was a little bit intimidated at first because I hadn't gone biking in a while, but the 500-watt motor that the electric e-bike comes with really gives you a nice little boost, especially if you're trying to go uphill or pick up some speed.
Data shows that e-bike riders take their bike out more often. That means you get more exercise, more exploration, and wait for it, fresh air.
And riding an e-bike isn't like, it's not cheating. It's just making it possible for you to be out there longer on each ride. And speaking of things going a little slower, you can finance an electric e-bike for as little as $49 a month.
Get into spring with electric e-bikes, the number one selling e-bikes in the nation. Get your adventure started at electricebikes.com. And please mention that What the Hack with Adam Levin sent you in the post-checkout survey.
That's electricebikes.com. I just got back from France and there was a lot of stuff I couldn't stream because I was in the wrong region. But using NordVPN, I was able to stream everything.
I use NordVPN too, but it's more to protect my private data, like bank details, passwords, and online identity. There are a million trackers online that are just sort of watching you. And NordVPN is a great way to get around those.
NordVPN can switch your virtual location, allowing you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price.
If you're traveling and you're using public Wi-Fi, NordVPN can protect you wherever you are.
It's not just that. NordVPN also comes with threat protection, which helps protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites.
NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world, and it'll only set you back the price of a cup of coffee a month.
To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/WTHack.
And hey, there's no risk. It's a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Check the link in the podcast description. Jeff Williams.
Oh, it's been 100 years. How are you doing?
It has been 130 years.
130.
131 years.
Actually, that was when Bo didn't have a beard.
No, Jeff knew me when I had one sideburn and I worked in the snack shop.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I thought that was during your Payas days, Bo.
No, that was just a one sideburn thing to be disturbing. And I worked the cash register at the snack bar.
Well, the good news is you don't need just one sideburn to be disturbing anymore.
No, I just have to be. That's very
was
nice
this in comments,
you, Adam.
Or...
Yeah, it was in commons.
And now you've got me thinking about those cheeseburgers in the snack bar, which there has never been more pleasure condensed into $3.50 anywhere since.
I agree. Those cheeseburgers were magic. So, Jeff, Adam doesn't believe we went to school together, and now he thinks that I studied acting.
You were a lit major, right?
I was a lit major. And you were, always, you were...
He was always lit? When you guys were in college?
I was always majorly lit. But I was always lit. But Jeff, you were a drama major, correct?
Yeah, technical theater. So I started in drama and then realized as I was in classes with Pete Dinklage and Justin Theroux that I didn't want to eat ramen for the rest of my life. And if that was going to be my competition, I'd probably end up that way. So.
Yeah, true story. We did have both Pete Dinklage and Justin Theroux were there at the same time.
Yeah, they're both very cool.
Well,
yeah.
It was good to go see the plays. The plays were quite good. So, Jeff, how did you get from VAPA at Bennington College to become the head of cybersecurity? I don't know if that's your title, but the head of security at Avast.
Not just head. Global head.
I am the global head. Having gone to Bennington, my head was big to begin with. So going global with that was just a natural progression. But seriously, as I think about the history, it's really been a series of being in the right place at the right time and being smart. So I kind of fell into going into technology because I didn't want to eat the ramen. I had intended to be part of the film industry, but I wasn't related to anybody. So there was a serious downside in trying to get jobs for pay that people were willing to take for free to get a credit. So I ended up moving into computers, which I'd always had a natural aptitude for. I'd been doing since I was six or seven. It turned out they wanted to pay people to do that. I thought that was pretty keen.
So did you actually go to Hollywood and try your hand at getting into the movies?
I did, Hollywood and San Francisco.
And then you started studying computers out there?
No, I didn't study. It's something I just always done. So,
So since we're on the subject of Hollywood, what's your favorite movie?
I did.
That's like asking a parent who their favorite child is. How do you pick one?
All right, top five.
My top five children?
No.
Wow. Nicely done, Jeff. I love you more.
I think at least three of my top five favorite movies are Blade Runner and the different versions that have come out.
Wow. All right. That's an answer. That is an
excellent
answer.
Taste. Ridley Scott would be proud.
How about your favorite hacking movie?
Oh.
Do you have one?
You know, we end up talking about this at work periodically as we try to come up with backdrops for all hands meetings and things like that when we want a theme. So I've gone through all of them. The obvious answer would be to say hackers, which just because it's so much fun. But I think I'm going to go with Spy Game.
Oh, nice. Spy Game. Good one.
So here's the deal. I use Yahoo Finance. I use it to make money because it works. Not just because they're a sponsor of the show. Heck, I've been using them for years before they ever called to become a sponsor. I do a lot of investing, and I need to make split-second financial decisions, and that's where Yahoo Finance comes in. I trade stocks, and I trade options, and you can't trade them in a vacuum. You gotta know what's going on. Yahoo Finance gives you the opportunity to look at the whole picture. I mean, breaking news, editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts. I love the customizable charts. They have it all. At Yahoo Finance, I'm part of a community of over 90 million users. You heard me. 90 million folks use Yahoo Finance because they're helping you on your way to financial success. Visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com, yahoofinance.com. So Jeff, after you were in college with Bo, but before you were head of security at Avast, you worked for Microsoft in the early 2000s, right?
Absolutely. Not too long thereafter is when we started to see viruses and worms just hitting everybody. So you think about Sasser, Slammer, Blaster, you couldn't turn your head at that point and not see 10 or 20 or 30,000 computers getting hit by some new worm. It was always in the press. It was always something you'd read about. And it was hard to stop because the software at the time, security wasn't on by default. I mean, we've come a long, long way in the last 20 years. But at the time, it was kind of a free-for-all with the miscreants, people who were trying to make a name for themselves. It hadn't even really gotten to the point of monetization. But then everything started to change, and we saw this acceleration. So at Microsoft, I ended up in a variety of security and privacy roles, security architect, later divisional privacy officer, and then ultimately a senior member of the Malware Protection Center.
Were you ever a part of the Microsoft Digital Crimes Unit?
I worked in parallel with the Digital Crimes Unit, so I was the liaison between the Malware Protection Center and the Digital Crimes Unit, and the work that I and members of my team were doing was to select the targets for takedown and to provide support on analyzing the malware itself and providing information so that the Digital Crimes Unit could do their work, and they did excellent work. They had technologists as well as lawyers, which is a really good combination for that kind of work.
Right. I think I just want to roll it back a little bit for our listeners. When you refer to worms, I know that they're not quite as popular, as big of a cyber threat right now. What exactly was a worm or is a worm?
Yeah, so a worm is a piece of malicious code that can infect a computer, and once that computer is infected, use that computer as a launching point to infect other computers.
Now, so, is this like Stuxnet, Jeff?
Stuxnet, I believe, is in fact a worm.
Okay, and so what are how are they different from a botnet?
So a botnet is a collection of machines which have been infected, and usually there's a command and control infrastructure where the bot herder, the person who owns the botnet, can send commands to all the infected machines to do a thing.
So now they're like the robot army, right?
It's very much like a robot army. And the things that they can do are, whatever the attacker has coded them to do. So they can send spam, they can do denial of service, they can install new software, new malicious software, anything that you can code up. Over time, we've seen a real evolution in the capability of these botnets. First, from single purpose doing something stupid like denial of service, all the way up to something that's, criminal in nature and monetary in function, whether that be ransomware or spam for profit or phishing or any number of things. And some even do a combination of this. And the ones that do a combination of this ended up being turned into crime as a service in many cases, where the bot herder would sell access to their botnet because they could do all these things. And so other criminals who might not have the capability to build their own botnet could join in the fun and do their bad things using the same botnet.
And now, to be clear, some of the crimes we're talking about were like the ubiquitous, oh, there's that big word, emails that we saw advertising drugs. And as we know, those drugs weren't always real, and they could be very dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of counterfeit pharma being sold through spam. You saw marketplaces getting stood up, you know, the Canadian pharmacies selling V1 Agra. And similar things to...
That's why it doesn't work.
Oh, poor Adam. No, you should have... You never buy off-brand Viagra. Poor guy.
All I can say is my C1 Alice seems to be working perfectly. But
Wah, wah. Yeah. But besides selling drugs, what else... Like, what kind of... I know I've heard of ransomware as a service, but crime as a service predated it, I'm guessing.
It did. And it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just Viagra and Cialis. It was any luxury goods. So, you know, any brand that you would recognize, whether that be Vernet or Rolex or whatever. And it could be real, it could be fake. You know, some of the things that were being sold online were real. So the criminals would go out and steal credit cards, and they'd use those credit cards to make purchases. And then they'd have all this merchandise that they didn't really want. And so the secondary portion of the attack was to fence the good.
So you could get a $10,000 Rolex for $1,000 or $500, real thing.
I'm just going to say conceptually, because I never did any test purchases.
No, you know, we did a recent episode with Brian Ebert, who was the chief of staff for the Secret Service, and he walked us through exactly that sort of scam.
I'm pretty sure that they did test purchases. That would be good evidence in court.
Yep.
What is the biggest current marketplace right now for cybercrime?
Oh, the biggest current marketplace, I mean, that changes all the time. And one of the good reasons that it changes all the time is that Europol and the FBI and the Australian Federal Police have gotten really good at taking them down. If we think back to when I was getting into this, law enforcement wasn't super excellent at taking down these sites. They didn't always have people on staff who had these technical skills. And so one of the early things, even before the Digital Crimes Unit at Microsoft was stood up, there was a need for companies like Microsoft and some of the other majors to go out and help law enforcement learn these skills. And so that was when I first got into this, around the time of Zotab, which was a worm that happened in, I think, 2005. That was one of the first things that I was involved in the takedown space. And that one I wasn't really very much involved in. I was aware of it, provided some information to some of the people who were doing the active work.
It sounds like in the very beginning, like back in 2005, when you were getting into this world, the police really had no way of making arrests in these or takedowns or anything like that, because they had no idea even that these things existed. Am I right?
Yeah, they not only was there, you know, not a high level of skill in some of the law enforcement agencies, but there also weren't laws on the book that specifically applied to things on the internet. You know, where exactly does a crime take place on the internet? Is it on the attacking computer, which might be in country A, or is it on the victim computer, which is in country B, or is it on the ISP that's in between them, or the five ISPs in five different countries that are in between them? So jurisdiction really becomes challenging. The interesting thing with Zotab, and I'm really impressed with the work that was done there, because they got arrests and prosecutions against the people responsible, which I think is, you know, one of the best outcomes you can have in one of these cases. They actually used money laundering and other laws that were already on the books that weren't specific to the internet. And so the authors who were, one was an 18-year-old in Morocco and the other was a 21-year-old who was in Turkey, were actually prosecuted in their local jurisdictions using these kinds of traditional laws.
Since we're talking about favorites today, you got a favorite story from your work in security you want to share?
I think the best one to talk about today would be the Roostock takedown, which happened in 2011. So this is after the Digital Crimes Unit had stood up, and they'd done a couple of takedowns already with Kelios A and Walladac, and had some great partnerships that they built with law enforcement and with the ISPs and the computer emergency response teams for countries around the world. Because when you do a takedown, it's not just enough to dismantle the infrastructure. You've got all of these computers that are still infected. And if another criminal came along and said, oh, there's a flaw in how you took that down, I'm going to go take over that botnet, all those computers would be back up doing their crimes again. And so cleaning up the computers becomes really important. And so as I was part of the Malware Protection Center at Microsoft, and one of the things my team was responsible for was the malicious software removal tool, the natural thing was for us to work with the ISPs and work with the certs around the world to give them custom tooling so that they could do that, so they could do the cleanup after the botnet takedown happened. So the Roostock takedown in 2011, the Roostock botnet was about somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million infected PCs. So really, really huge compared to what had come before, which you would have measured in the tens of thousands.
So this was the biggest to date?
I don't know if it was the biggest to date, because Conficker was around the same time, and Conficker was also quite large. But it was a new scale, and it represented the kind of criminal monetization efforts. You know, when you've got a monetary incentive to do this, you might work a little harder and go a little further and bring in additional resources because you know there's going to be a payoff. So Roostock was one of these Swiss Army knife, crime as a service kind of botnets. And it was pushing out just ridiculous amounts of spam. And so my role in the Malware Protection Center, in addition to doing the malicious software removal tool, also did anti-spam research. So I went to the research team, Terry Zink in particular, and Terry looked at the data to see, you know, where was the most prevalent, which botnets were most responsible for the global spam problem? Not just in terms of the volume of spam, but the difficulty in removing the malware associated with it, the persistence, the longevity of the botnet. And so we looked at it from a lot of different angles.
I think most people view that as being irritating, but how is that a cybersecurity threat?
Well, a lot of spam has links in it. And it's mm-hmm. the links which are sometimes malicious or lead right. to an action that a person might take that's against their interest. So buying something counterfeit mm. or giving away information or giving access to their own computer inadvertently.
So why is it interesting to Microsoft to stop them, Jeff?
So Microsoft's interest was really to protect the Windows ecosystem and protect Windows customers, because it had become such a pervasive problem that it was impacting the brand, that people were equating poor security with Microsoft. So Microsoft had done the big stand-up of trustworthy computing, saying, you know, we're going to change all of this and we're investing. And they took all the developers of Windows and made them stop developing code until they learned security, and then they could go back and develop their code securely. So a lot of things, you know, just fundamentally changed overnight with that memo in 2003 that Bill Gates sent around.
Well, didn't Bill Gates claim that he was going to eradicate spam forever?
Yes.
How'd that work out?
So an unfortunate statement with great intent behind it. And you know, the idea was that spam is a technology problem. Technology problems have solutions. Smart people can come up with good solutions to technology problems. But what the thinking didn't include is that it's not a technology problem. It's an adversary problem. And the adversaries will iterate on their attacks anytime their attacks stop working or anytime they can make their attacks better. And so the idea behind Bill Gates' statement about eradicating spam was to use this this old concept called penny black. So if you think about the original postal system, the early days of the postal system, you could put a penny black stamp on a letter, and the person receiving the letter would have to pay the tax. So this was a technology version of Penny Black, where there would be a computational challenge that the receiving computer has to, or the sending computer has to do in order to send the mail. And that computational challenge for one mail, not very impactful, just like a penny isn't very impactful to send a letter. But if you're sending a million pieces of spam, then that's a million computations that have to be done. And that's intensive on the computer. You need a bigger computer or more computers in order to do it.
All right. So the first question is, how successful were these spam bot attacks?
Hugely successful. I think at one point, spam accounted for 91% of all internet traffic.
Wow. So, all right. So in this case, you pretty much could say the technology doesn't always or even often solve cybersecurity problems.
I think that's kind of a miscasting of the technology. So technology isn't solving problems. It's the application of technology that solves a problem.
Yeah, no, but I think I would have said it the same way. I get the difference, but the way that you put it is absolutely brilliant. That there's an adversary problem.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, the difference between use and abuse is only two letters. There's not a big gap between using technology for good and using technology maliciously. It's dual use.
When you take down something like a huge botnet like this, what's the overall impact?
Well, in the case of Roostock, the impact was actually pretty huge. And as I mentioned, it was the most impactful spam bot at the time. And when the takedown happened, global spam was reduced by 75% overnight.
Wow.
And that lasted for a number of months until the bad guys came back with new botnets or the people who were buying crime as a service bought crime as a service from other botnets and started over with some other.
Overnight, 75% drop. Nope.
Overnight, a 75% drop in spam.
So Bill Gates' promise came true, and he loved you. How's that?
we tried. I don't know if Bill Gates even knows my name, but that's okay.
What do you think law enforcement learned from that? And then also, what do you think other cyber criminals learned from that takedown?
Well, so the legal side of this, I think the biggest thing that came out of Roostock is that Richard Boscovich, who was heading up the Digital Crimes Unit, still is heading up the Digital Crimes Unit, he came up with what I think is a pretty novel legal approach. Because the spam was targeting brands like Viagra and Rolex and whatever, he treated it as a trademark problem. And so worked with the court under the Lanham Act to allow the seizure of those servers as part of a trademark infringement claim. Really kind of interesting approach to going after the criminals directly.
So that's like a very unique setup that Microsoft had, where they had put together technologists and lawyers to figure out strategies to actually stop these people. And the trademark was the sort of the workaround that they found.
Absolutely. The combination of a legal and technical approach is so much better than just going after from a technical perspective. You know, the team could have pushed out malicious software removal tool, you know, till the cows came home, and there'd still be new malware infecting machines and so on. So it's playing whack-a-mole. But when you get the legal side of it right, then, you know, you're not only taking the infrastructure, but you create the chilling effect. In some cases, you might actually go after the individual. So a lot of these cases are filed as John Doe cases. You don't know who's responsible, but you know there's a responsible party. And so when the cases are filed, it's against John Doe. And then as you collect more information, like you might get from the forensics of examining servers taken from a co-location facility, which the attackers had connected to from their home machine, then all of a sudden that John Doe can turn into an actual person, and that person can be charged with crimes. And if you get an arrest, like I said, that's the best possible outcome.
Did brands get involved in the prosecution?
I believe that there were brands involved. I think that Pfizer wrote an amicus brief in support of the case. I think there was another brand, but I don't know if they've gone public about who it was. I don't know if it's a public record. But there were definitely luxury brands being harmed. And so the court looked at this as not just a technology problem, but a business problem.
And because of this, people were able to seize the infrastructure and use these seizures in order to do more forensic analysis, right?
That's right. That's right. And that forensic analysis of servers can lead to things like if the criminal is really good about masking the machines that they've infected, it never connects to them because they have a command and control infrastructure. If they connect to the command and control infrastructure from their own machine without obfuscation of any kind, that leaves, you know, these digital breadcrumbs that can then be followed in a traditional law enforcement kind of way from an investigation perspective. So if I see that IP address 1.2.3.4 connected at 10:17 p.m. to the server that I know was involved in the command and control, then I can go to the ISP and say, at that time, who had that IP address?
So, yeah, I think one of the main things I'm kind of wondering about here is if you can walk us through what the forensic steps were to be able to both identify and then to be able to take down this operation.
Sure.
And Bo and Adam, please let them speak.
will do.
So the case to the case preparation took several months, and it was not just the legal side of thing, getting the story that the court had to be told in order to get the outcome that was desired to seize the servers and so on. But there was a technical aspect. We had to enumerate the entire botnet. Where was it in the world? What IP addresses? How many? What countries? And so on. With that information, we were able to go to the cert for each of the countries and the ISPs that were hosting the infected IP addresses that we could see and say, you have a problem. We want to help you solve that problem. And can we have a conversation? And so this partnership kind of happens in silence. It's something where, you know, it's part of the investigation, so you keep it close to your chest. Operational security is tight. You don't even talk about it within your own companies so that, you know, only the people who are working on it who have that need to know are involved. When you get all of those pieces in place, then it can go to the court. And so the lawyers took it to, I believe it was a court in North Carolina, and went to the court and said, you know, we'd like a temporary restraining order that says we're able to go and seek the people responsible. And that was done under seal so that the court records didn't spoil the idea that we were going to do this takedown. The bad guys didn't, of course, appear in court to respond to the temporary restraining order because they're a criminal. Why would they?
Right.
Why are you going to show up and say, yeah, I did that. Leave me alone. because they're going to get walked out in bracelets. But the court saw that this was a business problem. This was a technical problem, that yes, crimes were being committed, that nobody had stood up to say, hey, don't do that. You've got the story wrong and I'm innocent. And so the court granted the request to take over the servers. And so the U.S. Marshal Service was called out. I think they went to 5 or 6 co-location facilities in the United States. I think there were 96 total servers involved in this globally. I'm not sure of the 96 how many were in the U.S., but it was 5 or 6 locations that they went into hosters and said, that server right there, I'm going to take it with me. And the hard drives from those were then pulled, contents of them examined, and so on. And while that forensic examination was happening, the remediation phase went into effect. So because Microsoft had taken over the botnet, all of the machines that were infected and calling home were now calling home to Microsoft's server. So the IP addresses that had been used for command and control were now Microsoft IP addresses. So all that traffic was going to the Digital Crimes Unit. And the Digital Crimes Unit was cataloging it by IP address and timestamp and going back to the ISPs and saying, here are the machines that need to be fixed.
So were the compromised devices here, were those computers, routers, IoT devices? Or?
Yeah, for Roostock, it was computers. The net effect of it, so in the first 7 days after controlling those IP addresses, 1.7 million unique IP addresses checked in to the botnet. So there may have been more at the time, computers that just weren't turned on or weren't connected to a network, but yet were still infected. But 1.7 million in the first 7 days. And I think the max number we saw was 2.4 million. So huge, huge botnet. And that partnership with the ISPs and certs, and also I should probably mention FireEye, Alex Landstein of FireEye was a malware analyst researcher who contributed to the work that was done along with people at Microsoft.
I think one of the things I'd like to just be able to break down for our listeners here is a lot of the time when we hear about things like malware or botnets and the like. It kind of it sounds like it's this huge abstract concept. In the case of the Rustok, how were those computers compromised?
You know, I don't actually have that answer. There were so many infections happening at the time that to say, you know, one infection vector versus another infection vector, you know, it could have been people clicking on things that they shouldn't have, whether it be on a website or in a spam email that they got from an earlier iteration of the botnet or from a different botnet. It could be people downloading software that isn't the real thing and so comes with malicious content included. Things they find in Usenet groups where they're downloading things to, you know, have cracks or, you know, pirated software, you know, in any number of ways people can get infected.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think one of the whole things about cybercrime is people tend to think like that's just something that happens. And then they don't really know that their own personal device can actually be compromised and then leveraged into a spam attack, for instance.
Yeah, well, it is just something that happens, but it's something mm-hmm. that doesn't have to happen. Because right. if you think today about the guidance we're giving people about, you know, here are the five things that you could do to improve your security, you know, use strong passwords and don't use the same password on multiple sites and use multi-factor authentication and keep your software up to date and keep your operating system up to date. You know, those things are the same things that we were saying in 2001, 2002, 2003. You know, it's been the same guidance all along. The challenge is that software manufacturers haven't made it easy for people to do the best thing for security. It's gotten better. It's certainly gotten better over time, but it's not easy yet. You know, the very fact that you need to remember a password to get into a site, but there's 100 sites that you need to get into, is something that just creates all kinds of problems. Are you going to use the same password at Amazon that you use at, you know, Joe's Pirated Software Emporium? You know, or are you going to use?
You can say the Pirate Bay. That's fine.
The Pirate Bay.
Yeah, you're right. That was a big one. But, you know, the idea that you're not in full control of that password once you have it logged on somebody else's site is a real problem of identity. You know, if they store it, if they store your personal information, then all of a sudden they're the custodian of it. And if they don't adequately protect it, it ends up in some breach that ends up getting sold in those same dark markets. You know, I think, you know, if you go to haveibeenpwned.com, you'll see that there are literally hundreds of millions of email password combinations that are available for sale in the underground.
We are the evangelists for Have I Been Pwned, but do you
ask them? Ask them, Adam. Ask them the password. Ask them the password question, man.
I'm dying to ask you the password question. Oh my God! So this big drive by Microsoft and Google and Apple to get people to do it another way. Yep. How do you feel about that one?
So I'm absolutely in favor of it. I think passwordless is a very powerful way to get away from a fundamental technology challenge. You know,
Jeff, yes. Did you see the Big Lebowski?
Hold my drink.
Dude, well, you remember the nihilists and they said, you know, that she cut her pinky off. You remember them? Like, what, people are going to start cutting people's thumbs off. I disagree.
I don't see the thumb cutting.
Jeff is stunned by the level of stupidity I just threw at him.
It was a pinky toe, for the record. It was actually popular singer Amy Mann's toe.
I think your scoring of actual risks doesn't put that one at the top of the list.
You know, whatever.
If you've got a situation where a criminal has the ability to cut off your finger, they can compel you to enter your password in lots of other ways.
Not if they're not Jack Bauer.
Stare at this cell phone.
Okay. We'll let him answer. Now I'll stop interrupting. Why do you think it's a good thing and how will they do it? Is it biometrics? Is it a token? What is it?
I think there's multiple ways to do it, biometrics, token, but I think the really important aspect of it is getting to that idea of self-sovereignty, that I control my identity. I don't have to have my identity on 100 different sites. I don't have to have my personal information on 100 different sites. I control it. I control where it goes. You know, right now, if I order something on Amazon, they have my password, they have my address, they have my credit card number, they have my order history and all the things that go along with it. And then in fulfilling that order. They give my address, name, and other information to UPS so that they can deliver it. They give information to Visa so they can process the transaction. And so there's all of this information that's going to multiple parties. And that's even before we start to get to the ad tracking and the cookies and things where my preferences and actions are being profiled. But if I've got all of this controlled on my own device in a tightly encrypted manner, and I choose where it goes, then I don't have to worry about that onward transfer. You know, UPS doesn't need to know of anything other than my address to deliver me a package. They need to know that it's authorized, that it should be going to my address, but they don't need to know my name even. They don't need to know what's in the box. They don't need to know anything like that. Visa doesn't need to know anything except I need money from Jeff, and here's the amount, and it's approved. And Amazon doesn't
need to. I kind of love this. You're selling it, man.
Amazon doesn't need to know my credit card. They only need to know that Visa says, yeah, he's good for it. Go ahead. So this idea of not having all of this sensitive and personal information stored in 100 different places in order to do the things that we do every single day reduces the risk overall. So I think there's a real power in putting things into the control of the individual, as long as the software providers make it easy for the individual to do the right thing.
Jeff Williams, you just knocked it out of the park. I now belong to the church of your way of looking at this.
No, we have always said that there's a shared responsibility and the individual plays a critical role in cybersecurity and in cyber hygiene. So we're all, this is the same choir. Yeah, we're all singing together here.
Absolutely.
I think it's something that people tend to overlook, where they look at the Venn diagram between privacy and security as being not a lot of overlap, but at the same time, yeah, I think you're completely spot on here, where your privacy is a matter of security, because the fact that when you know who has access to your information, that lets you know who is able to access your accounts.
Yeah,
but let me ask you one question, and that is, what if you lose your device in this tightly controlled internet secure world?
Well, you can't lose the cloud. So if you got your encrypted content stored in the cloud and available to all your devices and authenticated with biometrics or something else that's provable as you, then that problem is solved.
So something you know, something you have, and something you are. Yeah, but Jeff isn't storing something on the cloud, just storing something on someone else's computer.
The cloud is definitely someone else's computer.
So isn't that a problem?
Depends on the other person.
That's like the adversary problem,
but
the reverse.
The other guy. Well, look, the bad guys are always looking for ways to get after you, and they're going to get you.
Yeah.
And anything we can do to make it harder for them is going to help us.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. I want to go back to something that Travis said, though. He talked about the Venn diagram of security and privacy. And
right.
I don't actually view it as a Venn diagram, because I think they're too intertwined to be separated. I think that security is the how, privacy is the why.
That is an excellent way of putting that.
You are like that. I want Jeff to be the president of all things cybersecurity everywhere.
Jeff makes us look like a smart for having gone to Bennington.
So. Or he makes us look smart for just having known him.
But
I have a question.
Boys Club here, huh?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But so see, as Adam was saying, you know, we're all singing with the same choir. Jeff, did you sing with Randy's choir at Bennington?
I didn't sing with the choir, but I did take voice and I did do some performances. And so.
Okay, because I thought maybe that we sang next to each other. I was the world's worst tenor, but I guess not.
Well, maybe you guys could, you know, sing a cybersecurity song together.
Do you have a cybersecurity song? How does it go?
Sing a song.
No.
It doesn't have
stop.
To be long.
Please stop. Don't.
Just try not to be wrong. As we wrap this up, and we are eternally grateful for you sharing a few moments of your life with us, although apparently you shared part of your life with some of us before the rest of us. What tips would you throw out there for people, since we are the ultimate guardians for ourselves, our families, our companies. We are ultimately. So what tips would you do?
Well, I would say that just be cognizant of what you're doing online and the providers who you are trusting with your data. What are they doing? If you think about things like, well, really any social media site is not really serving you. They're serving advertisers and they're serving other data aggregators and they're profiting on your information. While it's not a bad thing necessarily, because they provide a free service to you in the process, free in quotation marks, you're paying with your data and information about your activities. Just be aware of what you're doing and know that other people are going to see that, people beyond just your friends. The whole idea of surveillance capital, the underpinning is that for person A to communicate with person B, person C has to make a profit from the conversation. It's a situation where we've really backed ourselves into a corner with the internet itself. By building everything on this. And I think that the way we take that back is by putting control into people's hands, passwordless and self-sovereign identity and some of the other things that are starting to come to more prominence, the Web3 kinds of ideas, I think are very, very powerful. And I hope that it democratizes information again, instead of putting it in the hands of a few very powerful entities.
All right. Thank you, Jeff, so much.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
It was a pleasure to be here. Right. Thanks, everybody. Right.
Thanks.
So Jeff said that after the Microsoft team took down the Rostock botnet, in just a few months, the bad guys moved on, spam levels rose again.
Hmm.
And he said the same tips that he was giving people back then are still tips he gives out today. Are we just doomed?
Yes.
Is this mm-hmm. type of attack unavoidable?
No, I mean, that was the whole thing that was so amazing about Jeff was he is the first person I've heard talk for any extended period of time on the topic of cybersecurity and privacy who made me feel like there might be hope.
So we don't have to move to the country like you and hang out with bears and tractors.
Oh, I just fixed my tractor, which I ran over a rock and it got, anyway, you don't want to hear. We don't. No, we don't. I think we can just, the thing that I was allergic to, the password-free situation, sounds really promising.
It does, especially when you consider the parties involved there. That's Apple, Google.
There's going to be
parties? Yeah.
Well, yeah.
A rave or like a...
There'll be a celebration of privacy.
Oh, that kind of party. Because, it is interesting that those are the biggest players.
We know that Apple, Microsoft, and Google are, that's the list so far, at least the headliners. Is there anyone else big time that should be on that list that, at least as far as we know, isn't on the list?
All right, 100%. I have one. You only get one each, or Travis, you can go. Who's yours?
I'd say any major internet provider in China.
That's rather specific.
Well, that is right now. I mean, they have a huge population. That's a really big market. But when we talk about Apple, Google, Microsoft, those are U.S.-based companies, and the internet is a global phenomenon. It's a global environment.
This has been an episode of me understanding in a very humble way that I'm dumb.
Finally.
Well, it had to happen. But the because mine was very different from that. I think that on that list should be, Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, when he takes possession of Twitter, and all of the other major portals that are, let's face it, social media is the way people, quote unquote, go online, a lot of people.
And I certainly think that any organization that is dealing with children and children's information absolutely needs to do that as well.
Yeah, and it's not just, TikTok obviously was in my grouping of social media, but... but the internet touches, everyone's lives and it's sort of indiscriminate. I think that's kind of the point is it would be nice if we could fine tune the way that individuals experience it.
Well, and think about the fact that for many people in the world, Facebook is the internet for them. There is nothing else.
Well, I think one thing that we often overlook too, though, is that Facebook or Meta in general, and Google and Apple and Microsoft all have such a huge reach that if they can actually commit to doing one change, then that will actually have a global impact.
I think Jeff should be in charge of the whole thing.
I'm with you on that.
Make it so.
Make it so, number one.
Well, I mean, I'm bowled over. I think that this episode was the, I have to say, we did the favorites in the beginning, which I thought was a little tedious, but no offense, everyone else who's been on the show, this is at this very moment, Sally Field style, who I really liked this episode. Right now, I really like this episode. I learned so much.
Are we saying...
Do you hear that, Dana Dute? Do you hear that with your anchovies?
Yeah.
Ooh, that was cold, man. I meant right now.
You're fishing for something there, my friend.
Wow, Travis, you're bad.
We've emailed back and forth a few times. We've come to an agreement on NATO, so we're good.
Okay, good.
I feel so much better about that now. I can go to sleep at nights.
Yep. I'm not switching. I'm not going to change horses on this one, but I do really love that Dana Dute episode as well.
Mm-hmm. But we also need to hear from our listeners. In addition to, you know, when you do your ratings and you write the reviews, tell us whether or not you think the favorites list is tedious. I'm hurt. I'm wounded.
No,
I'm
because crushed. What if they think it? If they think it's tedious, you're going to be even more hurt because they're going to be like four stars because the list that the best of thing was tedious.
Okay, so I tell you what. Then our listeners, when they're rating us, you know, in between the stars, can tell us what their favorite episode is of this show.
Fair enough. I think that. Yep. I'm down with that. I think that'll stop them from giving you four stars and making you very sad.
I don't want to be sad.
I want to be happy.
I want to be glad. I want to be happy and glad and never again be sad. I never will cry. I never will sigh because I want to be glad.
He never will cry. He never will sigh because he wants to be glad. And now the world looks bright and fair because the sun shines everywhere.
What the Heck with Adam Levin is a production of Loud Tree Media.
It's produced by Andrew Steven, the man with two first names.
You can find us online at loudtreemedia.com and on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Adam K. Levin.